It's true that we moved very slowly before that time. Well, it took us, they celebrated the 100th anniversary of the 14th Amendment last July. The 100th anniversary. I bet none of you knew about it. I didn't know about it myself till they asked me to make a speech. And they asked me to speak on this worldwide hookup that the State Department has. And I looked into it, and of course it's taken years and years and years. As a matter of fact, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment never became of age, until 1954. Oh, there were little smatterings now and then, little siblings that died off. It started and then died off. But in 1954, when Brown came along, well, you had a strong, virile, adult 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, and since that time, it's grown into real manhood. And it's going to stay there, I think. And I hope so. Those cases, beginning, many people have forgotten. Shelley against Kramer, a monumental case in this area. You read it over and you'll find language in there. I wasn't on the court at the time. As a matter of fact, we filed a brief. I was in the Department of Justice. We filed a brief against the covenants at that time. But you'll find language in there by who? By Fred Vinson. Now, many people would teach you, not here at Harvard, of course, that Fred Vinson was a reactionary Chief Justice. But he wrote Shelley and Kramer, upon which two of the cases, or later cases, are based, that had brought about much of the advancements in this area. And another case he wrote was Sweat. You remember, Sweat was the law school graduate down in my law school in Texas, who they wouldn't let in. And Chief Justice Vinson wrote that. And if you'll read Brown, you read Brown when you go down to the library tomorrow, and you'll find that Brown quotes Sweat, refers to it in two instances as basis. Well, my time's up. You know, Mary gave me this watch. Mary's my wife, so there'd be no misunderstanding about that. And she said, you know, Tom, I love you, but when you get to talking, you don't have any terminal facilities. So I'm supposed to stop at this time, but I will just wind up a few. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I was going to talk about Jones and Mayer. My son argued that, incidentally. I'm very proud of that decision. Because of that, I did not sit, but it's after I went off the court. But it's a monumental case, although the hat's hung on the 1866 Civil Rights Act. But still, the court always tries to hang its hat on something that, isn't quite so controversial as just, as people say, taking things out of thin air, you know, and giving them substance. And so the Civil Rights Act did have this provision in it, and so they hung their hat on it, and bless them for it, because it goes much further than the Civil Rights Act of 1968, believe it or not. And it was written in 1866. So you can see how far we've advanced. Well, you take in demonstrations. You hear a lot about demonstrations nowadays. You heard Justice Black the other night talk about demonstrations. Now, I don't agree with him on some of it, but that's all right. You don't agree with a lot of things I say. That's all right, too. If you don't agree, you can just forget about it, I hope. We'll still be friends. We'll be like the story Bob Hope told me. I was going over to Baltimore the other day to come up to New York, and Sarge Shriver was coming out of the building, and he said, Bob's downstairs, Bob Hope. So we just came up from Dallas, that's my hometown. And I said, what'd you do down there? He said, oh, we dedicated a building to Bob O'Donnell, who was a movie exhibitor down there. He said, you know, Bob started his Keith Orpheum circuit in Dallas, Texas, many years ago. And so he thought it was fitting that he'd come there, Bob O'Donnell having passed on, dedicate this building. And so he came there, and the president of SMU, and he was out at SMU, and they went to dedicate it, and Bob made this little speech, and during the speech he handed Mr. Dixon a little check. I said, how much was it? He said, $500,000. I says, pooh, Bob ought to be ashamed. He should have given $1 million anyway. But I went on downstairs, and Bob was saving me a seat. And I said, what are you going to do in New York? He said, oh, I'm not going to New York. I'm going to Philadelphia. I said, well, this plane don't stop in Philadelphia. You better get off. He said, oh, I think it will. And it did. And he got off. But during the time, he told me several stories of some ladies here. I'm going to tell you one of them. But this was about Sister Agnes. And Sister Agnes was a devout nun, and she died one day, and she found herself in hell, and she was very much disappointed. And she picked up the phone, and she called St. Peter, and she said, hello, St. Peter, this is Sister Agnes. Said, you know, I'm down here in hell. And he said, oh, yes, Sister Agnes, I know. He said, we're crowded up here, and we don't have room just now, but be patient. I'll send down for you. And so she waited about a week, and she didn't hear anything, and she called up against the little St. Peter. This is Sister Agnes. Said, you know, I'm still down here in hell, and they taught me to smoke and drink. Said, I wish you'd hurry and get me. And he said, well, we're getting things straightened out. In a few days, I'm going to come down there in my own chariot, bring you up. She waited a few days, and she didn't hear anything. She called him up. She said, hello, Pete. This is Ag. Forget about the whole thing. So just forget about the whole thing if you don't agree with me on some of these things. I hope you won't, because we'll have a discussion about it. Then I wanted to talk to you some about apportionment. You know, the greatest right that Americans have, or any free people have, is the right to vote. Provided that the vote's counted and that it has the same weight as everybody else's vote. The Supreme Court of the United States has given you all three of those rights. I mean, to all peoples. And the Congress has implemented them throughout the South by creating certain types of bureaus that would see to it that those who had been deprived of the vote during their lifetime then had it. And so now you have not only the vote, you have it counted. Classy said that you had it counted. Kesar, you incidentally. They also have now given it the weight, everybody the same way, Baker and Carr. And that line of cases. One man, one vote. The Supreme Court has brought that all about since 1961, only 6 or 7 years ago. An amazing thing. Taking school desegregation, I haven't even mentioned that. You think that's the greatest opinion. Well, it's a great opinion. I think the voting opinion, Baker and Carr, will have more influence, more effect upon the American people and upon our form of government and will the desegregation case. But I don't intend to say that or to talk down the desegregation case at all. It has momentous effects. It's a great landmark in our jurisprudence and in our steps forward to bring equality and justice and fairness and decency and humanness to every American. Those are some of the things that the Supreme Court's giving you. Well, you hear a lot of criticism of the court. A lot of criticism. I get around quite a bit. I don't know how many law schools I've been to this year, Don, but I would guess 20 at least. I've been to 4 this past 2 weeks, all the way from, Arizona to Harvard, and 2 intermediate stops. And I talk to law students about these things, and I talk to professors, and I talk to academic students, and I talk to the public about them. And I think that they really believe in these cases of the court, but they have never understood them. I had a letter the other day, a gentleman who Dr. Graham had written. I don't know either one of them. And Dr. Graham had been very critical of my Shemp opinion, you remember, in the public school prayer case. And it had been said that I had kicked God out the front door and let the communists in the back of the church. Well, of course, that's old Tommy Rot. And I paid no attention to it when I was on the court and pay less attention now. But this letter that this gentleman wrote me about Dr. Graham, I said, well, I'm sending you a copy of Shemp, and I hope you'll send it to Dr. Graham because I'm sure he hasn't read it. And I doubt if he has, from a criticism that he gave the opinion, because it said that it wipes out religion from being taught in the public schools, which is not true. Indeed, in footnote after footnote, I said that you could teach comparative religion in the public schools of our country, and I've made speeches over the country. Indeed, to all of the teachers in the religious studies of the University of California, which had about 1,000 of them. We had a seminar for 3 days on this very subject, and I'm going to have one down in Florida. I think it's next April, on the same subject. And that's the problem. And that's the problem where you come in. You can help to interpret these opinions. Even though you don't agree with them, you can at least interpret them and tell people where they're wrong in some of the things that they say about them. And in that way, you can render a great service. It's good to be here with you tonight. I'm going to have to catch an 11 o'clock plane, but we're going to have plenty of time for you to ask questions. And if Don, how you want to conduct this?
Well, why don't sit down here?
I think in order for the justice to make his plain that we should put an absolute cutoff on questions of 10 o'clock and preferably a little earlier, following the usual procedures at the forum, these programs are taped for rebroadcast, and therefore we must ask that anyone who would like to ask a question come to the front and use the microphone right in front of me. It would probably save time for others who wish to ask questions to come to the front so that we don't waste too much time in walking forward. And we only ask in addition that you state your name first. Are there any questions? Or let me ask.
My name is Gary Eldon, and I have a question on the desegregation cases. 14 years after Brown, in most of the southern states where the segregation was really a problem, there's still virtual segregation. Very few states have even gone beyond 10% desegregation. And Justice Black, commenting on that on his TV show, said that he thought it was a mistake using the phrase all deliberate speed. They should have required very speedy compliance with Brown. And I wonder if you, looking back on it, you're naturally not trying to say they were wrong at the time, but looking back on it, if you had it to do over again, do you think the court should have required immediate compliance or virtually immediate compliance with the Brown decision?
Well, we took deliberate speed from an opinion of Mr. Justice Holmes. At the time, we thought that, this was an opinion that really shook at the very roots of some of our southern states, that it would take some time. And of course, we didn't think it'd be eternity. We didn't mean by deliberate that you'd just do nothing. So it was an unfortunate phrase, I thought, that we used. Just as one or two other things in the opinion might have been unfortunate, like citing Myrtle, things like that that have brought the opinion into criticism that it wouldn't have suffered otherwise. But we're just human, too. Some people think that we're not, that we have horns, but we don't. We make mistakes, and we've been trying to correct this. I think you'll find that it has been, well, not corrected, but I think the steps have been taken that are bringing about a correction of it. In the recent case of the busing, and while I was on the court, we had cases that turned down the free choice, as they called it, where there wasn't any free choice, but they if a person chose for his children to go to a certain school, well, that was the end of it. So we held that that was not in compliance with the requirements of the 14th Amendment. So I rather think that although it's going to take some time, that it will be better. Of course, it never will be. I think we better be practical and frank about it. It's never going to be perfect, I don't think, for a long time. It's been here for years and years and years and years, and even in the North, why, it's bad. It's bad, and you're going to have to take it just, I think, educated into the souls and the minds and the hearts of people. We can't pass down mores and morality and things like that. We can preach it, and we can tell people what's right in opinions, and we can declare that this and that and the other's right. But I go through Tennessee, and I doubt if there's there's many school districts over there that pay any attention to either Vitale or Shemp. And in some parts of the South, quite a few don't pay any attention to Brown or any of its progeny. Now, it's going to be that someday that it's going to be obeyed, but it's going to take some time, it's going to take some education, it's going to take some soul searching, it's going to take some, I think, some crusading by good people like you. You're young enough to do it. I'm not. I'm too old. I'm 69 years old. I won't be here too many more years. But you can do it because you're young and you have the zeal and you have the determination and you have the idealism. I never saw a group of youngsters that have the idealism, the zeal, and the dedication and the determination that these young people have today. We really have improved upon ourselves, and I look forward with great confidence and you're being able to bring this about. Any other question?
I'm Mr. Charles Hodge, and I have a question for you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Of your opinions, one of the most interesting ones I've read is your dissent in a little federal case on reapportionment, 44th General Assembly, Colorado versus Lucas.
Yes.
I was wondering if you'd make some general comments on whether you think a little federal plan, in effect, is actually in violation of the Constitution. I know that your opinion stands for itself, but I wish if you'd probably elaborate on it. Also, one of the cases which was just handed down last year, a Texas case from your home state, Avery versus Midland County, do you believe it was right for the court to expand the Reynolds versus Sims doctrine to local municipal governments?
Well, taking your questions in reverse, I do not think that the court should have extended it. I indicated that in a couple of opinions that I wrote, one out of New York the last year I was on the court, should not have extended the doctrine to local government. I say that because particularly counties, the county in Texas has very little governmental functions other than road supervising. I used to represent my county, Dallas County, for many years, and we had it divided into four parts, and each one was sort of a road overseer, each commissioner, we call them. They passed perfunctorily the tax rate, but that was decided by statute. They had to pass it a certain way, a certain percent, and add on what the state tax was, so they had no discretion about it at all. So I rather doubt that that's true, because what's going to be, and I'm afraid it's going to come pretty quick, is the real dictatorship of the rural areas, which we have been experiencing, and which brought about, I think, the ghettos that we have and the slums in our cities, because the rural legislators would not vote any money to try to correct these things for so many years, and finally the federal government had to come in and try to correct them, but late and too little, and so they haven't been corrected even yet. But when you reverse that and put all of the power, and it's all there now under Avery, in the cities, in the suburban areas, well, then you're going to see the reverse of things happening. And all the rural areas going to be in bad shape. If we could have a sort of a balance. Now, my idea, and I come now to your first question, my idea was that if we had what I call a federal analogy, as you know, in our federal government, well, we have a Senate made up of two senators from every state. It don't matter whether you have 12 million people in your state or 12,000. You still get two senators. On the other hand, the House is made up of by population. And therefore, every man has his one man, one vote there. But all legislation you'll find is an accommodation. It's accommodation. One force hits against another force. And before long, why, rather than knocking their heads to pieces, well, they accommodate one another, and out comes a piece of legislation. And that's why we've been successful on the federal side, is because the House speaking for the people, being close to it, and the Senate being more removed from the people and having longer tenure, well, they're able to see things a little bit differently. Like a judge that's appointed for life sees things quite differently from one who has to run every 4 years. And one that runs every 2 years sees things differently from the four-year one. And so I think if we'd had the federal analogy, as I said in Colorado, as you indicated, in Colorado, it's very mountainous. I don't know whether you've been out there much or not, but that used to be my circuit way back. Time Don was with me, and I used to get out there quite often. And some of those old mountaineers live way up on top of those peaks, and now they won't have any representation at all, none at all, because the fellows down in the valleys are going to have all the representation under this Avery case. Before, if under what had been adopted, mind you, adopted by Colorado under an initiative and referendum, they adopted. This wasn't just a bill of the legislature. This thing was adopted. Adopted by a majority of every county in Colorado. Every county, not just one county here and a majority of counties, but every county by a majority. And it provided what I call a federal analogy, which the court struck down. So I think that was wrong, and I think the court's going to come to not to change it, but they're going to conclude that it was wrong, because it's going to place, I believe, the dictatorship in the urban areas. And then our rural districts, our farming areas are going to be hurt. And then somebody's going to have to take care of them, and we're going to have the whole cycle over again. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I have one. You just spoke about that it was the responsibility of us as young people to be zealous and perhaps crusade for causes that we believed in. You were speaking about civil rights. And you also said that before that you disagreed with some of Justice Black's opinions about demonstrations, which he seemed to be against. I note in our, in our program guide that it says you're generally a dependable vote against restrictions on police. What would you have to say then about the reports that have come out on demonstrations in Chicago this summer?
Well, I don't know too much about them. But from what I read, I think it was a very unfortunate circumstance and one that could have been averted. And both sides are guilty. Sometimes I think perhaps the police were the more guilty. Sometimes I think perhaps the others. Some people say, and some of the evidence seems to indicate, that some came there to make trouble. Others say not. I'm one to believe that there's no absolute even in the demonstration area. I think I heard Justice Black say the other night that you can't walk around and around and around, I think he said, and parade in front of a fellow's house. Well, I differ with that. I think you can do that. So long as you don't block the sidewalk where a fellow couldn't get by, or so long as you don't block traffic, things of that kind. Even Steiner held that, and Steiner's almost been overruled since it was handed down by Bob Jackson back 20 years ago almost. But I think that the police can, if they're properly trained, that's where we've fallen down considerably, control demonstrations, not with a billy, or not with a gun. I've rather come to the conclusion that perhaps we should be like the English and not carry guns, and maybe we'd be better. I haven't come to complete rest on that, but I rather think so. They can do more, I believe, by being a little bit more understanding than they have been. For example, if you would let some people sort of vent their spleen some, you'll find that they quiet down. Like Jim Bennett, used to be the head of our prisons, told me that when we started putting a law office once a month in the prison and told the prisoners that they could come to the law office and tell their troubles, and that these boys, we had some youngsters, seniors from the law schools that went to this room every month along with two lawyers. Jim told me that that was real therapy. It was much better than any therapy that a psychiatrist could have prescribed, and that these fellows got it off their chest, and that the deportment in the penitentiary was much better. And I rather think that if the police in Chicago had practiced a little bit restraint and perhaps let some of this go on to some extent, not let it get out of hand, but let it go on to some extent, well, it wouldn't have reached the proportions that it did. I think that's true also in the educational institutions, where it's, I think, a lack of communication. I noticed that Ed Levy, Ed was in the antitrust division, Don, you remember? Who's the new president, I think they call him, of Chicago, has appointed an omnibus bond for Chicago University. And a student can come in and make any complaint he wants to. Pretty good, might be a pretty good idea. Maybe Harvard could take a leaf out of it.
Oh, we have about a half a dozen ombudsmen around us.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
My name is Jim Rowe. Mr. Justice Clark, I wonder if you would comment on what qualities and characteristics you think the President of the United States should look for when appointing a Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Well, of course, I think the Chief Justice should be a lawyer or a judge. In a way, he should have a license to practice law. Justice Black the other night pointed out that you didn't have to be a lawyer, and that's true. And I agree with him that perhaps a non-lawyer, maybe in one post in the court, wouldn't be bad. Take a learned philosopher or a learned educator. Might be very good, as a matter of fact. It would be a leveling and influence, perhaps, to the other judges, and bring to it another discipline that might be good. A Supreme Court justice is more than just a judge. More than just a judge. And the Supreme Court is more than just an ordinary court. It has many problems and policy problems that are so momentous and so far-reaching that you have to consider them not only from a standpoint of the law, but from a standpoint of policy and other things. And perhaps an individual who had been learned in his discipline might add something to the court. But the chief should first be learned in the law, I think. In other words, he should be versed in not only substantive law, but in adjective law and procedures and things of that kind. Two, he should have a vast public experience, I think, if it's possible, along with an administrative experience. Chief Justice Warren is a very fine administrator. They tell me I was not on the court at the time, and Chief Justice Stone, for example, was not as good an administrator, but a greater, perhaps a deeper student of the law. He was a former dean and professor than is Chief Justice Warren. But Chief Justice Warren, by far, I think, is one of the great administrators of the court has ever seen. And I think will go down, perhaps, as great a Chief Justice as Marshall. I don't think that this man that you're talking about has to be one that you can't find. He doesn't have to be a godly person at all. I think, you know, on the other hand, he should be a person who has a common touch and would not carry with it any ostentations or things of that kind. It's hard to describe a man for that spot. It's a very difficult place. But I think the country's been fortunate in having, out of the 14 chief justices, some very fine ones. And I don't think of a one that was a poor one, but they've had some that are better. Does that answer your question, sir? Any other questions?
My name is Tom Butler, sir. I wonder if you could comment on the recent proposals to modify the Fifth Amendment, and particularly what you think, if you think there are great dangers involved in taking away these right to refuse to answer questions in a public trial where there's no possibility of real coercion, which apparently was the reason behind the Fifth Amendment being passed in the first place.
Well, in short, I'm against it. I'm against it for several reasons. One is that the minute you start tampering with the Fifth Amendment, you're not going to be able to tamper with it the little that you are proposing. It's going to get out of hand, and it's going to come up in a much I'm afraid, a much different form than what you propose. And you start tampering with those things, why, it goes from worse to worse. Two, the minute you open doors, first you put your foot in it. Pretty soon you got 2 feet in it. Pretty soon the door's all the way open. And the first thing you know, through interpretation or otherwise, why, it gets pretty bad. And although you might say that this applies to only public proceedings, why, before too long there's going to be possibly some interpretation of what's public and other things that might get into it and cause some problems. I think we have lived pretty well, as I said a few moments ago, and done pretty well with what we have. And I think the framers were really very, very propitious when they thought of all the angles. We've had many cases since that time. We have 3,500 every year in the Supreme Court alone. Just think of the millions that we have in the United States. And as you think about it, well, it hadn't been bad. Of course, sometimes some people have been mistreated, perhaps. Sometimes maybe some fellow that's guilty has gone free, but that's much better than having one that's innocent to be be hung or imprisoned, isn't it? I think we can stand that. That's not too great a price for us to pay. It's just like the jury. They talk about, well, we're all behind, we're clogged up in all of our cases and one thing or another. Let's abolish the jury system in civil cases. And the Chief Justice of New York really proposed this. I was amazed. That's one of the great protectors that's been handed down to us ever since the days of, well, Magna Carta. I don't see how we could ever bring ourselves to abolishing the jury system, and I can't see how we'd ever abolish myself or tamper with. It's sort of sacrosanct to me, the First and the Fifth and, well, all the amendments. They're pretty close to my heart, and I would hope you wouldn't bother them. Yes, sir. Any other questions?
I have the unfortunate duty, Mr. Justice, I think, of indicating at this point that we really have time for no more than one or at the most two questions. Again, I'll have to ask Ms. Gross. Yeah.
My name is Mark Glass, and earlier this week, Professor Freund indicated that he thinks, in light of the growth of the 14th Amendment that you've spoken to earlier, that we may see the use of the 13th Amendment, particularly in racial cases, questions involving racial discrimination, rather than the 14th, so that it could be, the expansion of the law could be more carefully limited. Do you expect to see the use of the 13th in any significant
degree? Well, we haven't been able to do it because the Congress has never been able to bring itself around. The courts don't like to pass on these things. Many people think that we just itch to pass on these things, but when I came on the court, well, the segregation cases were there. That was 1949. And we decided Sweat, which is a graduate school case in 51, but we never decided a high school case until 1954. We sent the Brown case itself back to South Carolina because they had voted a bond issue to improve the schools. And we thought, well, maybe they'll improve them to where they will be equal. And still on the Plessy Doctrine. And then in 1954, well, it came back, well, we decided to overrule Plessy. So we don't like to do these things. If the Congress could be brought around to implementing these amendments to where they could do something with them, why, it would be much better. Legislation is always better than adjudication. Adjudication is aimed at one thing, usually, one thing. It's hard for a court to broaden its judgment out.
I think I may have misstated my question. I'm not referring to using any of the amendments rather than legislation, but rather using the 13th rather than the 14th as the basis for the court's decision, since by interpreting the 13th and its prohibition of slavery and to include the vestiges of slavery, it could apply to racial cases where it would not apply the broader sweeps of the 14th. And therefore might be preferable, according to Mr. Freund. I just wonder if you'd agree or disagree with that.
You could do that. I thought you were speaking of the provision with reference to implementation. But you could, might be a little bit, well, it wouldn't be any more difficult than due process, I suppose. Some people.
Take one more question, yes.
My name is David Oshinsky. I'd like to know, you talk about the law having to have compassion. I would like to know why the Supreme Court and yourself as Attorney General and in many of your majority opinions have shown so little compassion for the aliens and the immigrants, especially in cases involving internal security, cases where there has been a long imprisonment on Ellis Island, cases where you voted against declaratory judgments, and many cases like in the Mazzai case on Knopf versus Shaughnessy, where fair hearings were not really granted because it was felt that under some under some circumstances, which were later proven to be untrue, the Attorney General thought that a hearing in this case might be against the national interest. And in several cases, this proved untrue, where the information that the Attorney General thought he had was either hearsay or was entirely untrue.
Well, most of the cases with reference to deportations are handled by a board, Immigration Appeals Board. And the Attorney General very seldom sees those. I had an assistant that handled those matters. As a matter of fact, Judge Holzhoff handled most of them when I was before he went on the bench. While it would come to me, and this is not any excuse at all, it would come to me more in the form of a memorandum than it would in the original documents themselves. As far as my other votes on the court, it may be that one that's had the background that I've had would be influenced that way. It just as one who had not had that background might be influenced. I suppose that, well, unconsciously you're influenced by your background and your training and your friends and what you've done in the past, your type of work you've done and everything. Even your geography might influence you some. I don't think it's an influence that you can put your finger on. And perhaps I might have been influenced in that way. As you grow older, why you change that way? Many times people ask me, well, when you're Attorney General, you said this. And I said, well, I was Attorney General then. Now I'm a justice. And so now I say to you that I was a justice then. I call them as I saw them. Maybe I saw some of them wrong. I'm human too.
Can I just
but
ask?
I think now that in some instances, well, I'm ready to admit that some of my cases could have been corrected.
We're going to have to stop at this point. And all I will say is, on behalf of myself and the audience, Mr. Justice, we're extremely grateful that you came up to talk to us this evening.